So I am feeling sad. this time seemed to go very quickly, and it's been very much my pleasure to be here with you and share the Dhamma with you, talk about Dhamma with you, hear about your practice, learn from you as well as the other way around. So I just want to say thank you. Thank you very much for your support and especially for your enthusiasm for the Dhamma. So good for the heart. So we've been talking about these three characteristics of all mental and physical phenomena, the insights of insight meditation, the things that we want to see. Because of their that kind of seeing having such a liberating effect on the heart. And so we talked first about impermanence, and then about suffering or unsatisfactoriness. And tonight I want to look at this last one, which is that weird one that sounds so strange, the teaching on non-self. And I told you the first night that we got together that it's actually been my experience that this one is actually in many ways quite much easier to see than we make it out to be, and probably because it sounds so weird, you know. And so and we're all, perhaps especially as Westerners, very invested in being a self and having a self and, you know, myself, I like myself, I don't like myself, all of that kind of stuff that goes on around the self. And so when you hear the Buddha's teaching, and he seems to be saying that we don't have a self, then, you know, that sounds completely and utterly crazy. You know, and what can he possibly mean by this? But just to say, you know, at first glance agree that it does sound a bit crazy, but he never actually said that there is no self. You know, he never actually put it in that kind of language. It's often the way it gets quoted. And in fact, when he was challenged and asked directly about this issue, in one of the very famous suttas that often gets quoted around it, where this wanderer comes up, and, you know, he's kind of one of these stump the teacher kind of wanderers, you know, and just wants to get the straight shtick on this teaching because it was unusual at the time. And his name is Vajragota. And so he comes up to the Buddha and he asks him, is there a self? And the Buddha doesn't say anything. He didn't answer. And then he asks, well, maybe you can almost have the sense of him scratching his head, well, maybe I asked it wrong, you know. And he comes back with, well, is there not a self? Or is there a not self? And still the Buddha remains silent. And then the wanderer, you know, I could imagine what he's feeling. You know, he just shakes his head basically and goes on wandering again and leaves, and totally unsatisfied with the Buddha's response. As were, I'm sure, anybody else who was in earshot. You know, but Ananda, the cousin of the Buddha and the Buddha's attendant, saves the day, as he often did in situations like this. He's very close to the Buddha and had the kind of a relationship where he could basically go to him and say, now wait a minute, what just happened? You know, he asked you if you had a self, he asked you if there's a not-self, and you didn't say anything. Why didn't you answer? Why didn't you say anything? What is the answer, basically? And the Buddha says that he didn't answer because neither one is true, neither one is right. And you see this many times in the suttas where he doesn't answer when the question itself is off, or it causes sort of a double bind or a false dilemma or something like that. You know, he doesn't answer it. What he says basically is that neither one is true. And this is a very interesting. So it's just to contemplate that he's not saying that it's one way or another. And you can see the dilemma ourselves. If we believe that there is no self, then just consider the effect that that has on the way that we can have, on the way that we live our lives. One of the things that's very important in Buddhist practice is developing, the language sort of fails when you try to describe this, but it's sort of like developing a very strong inner core. You know, the precepts are directed towards this, a lot of insight and understanding is directed towards this, where over the months and years of practice, what one finds happening is that, and I often talk about it as standing taller and sitting taller in the saddle, you start to get very, very clear, don't you? I mean, especially those of you who have been at it for some time, on what's important in life. And you get very, very clear on what we value. And there's an inner strength that develops from this, you know, that for what maybe there's a lot of different names we could give it, you know, a sense of integrity, a sense of self-respect, just that strong inner core. And so, you know, if we deny that, or deny a self, we're sort of denying a possibility of doing that. You know, something, it's me. I feel strongly about these things, and I have a profound and deep sense of integrity. And so this, you know, basically what I think what he's saying in this is that this is not a problem. Don't make this a problem. This is actually part of what we want to do as Buddhist practitioners. You call it what you will. You know, some might call it a strong sense of self, and that's okay. But, and then on the other hand, the other side of the dilemma is if we believe there is a self, and this is what often happens when you hear this teaching, Buddhist practitioners, well, I have a sense of a self, and I'm supposed to have a not-self. You know? And so you get this setup in practice where we're struggling very hard to free ourselves from a self that never existed in the first place. You know, you get this amazing tangle going on. And this is very common among Buddhist practitioners. I know I went through it. And many people that I talk to go through it, where you get caught up in this. It's almost like having a war on personal pronouns, you know, or anything. Anytime you hear yourself referring to something about yourself, you go, you know, I'm not supposed to do that. I'm not supposed to have a self, you know. And this is, I mean, you can see just as you name it and put it out like that, that this is crazy too. I mean, this is not what he's saying. We're not trying to get rid of something that didn't exist, and we're not trying to go to war with this capacity of the mind to look at itself and to refer back to itself. So, you know, clearly the Buddha seems to be saying that arguing the existence or the non-existence of a self is totally not productive. Don't even go there. You know, it doesn't make any sense at all. And certainly not suggesting that we enter into any kind of battle with self-referential designations. You know, you read the scriptures, you read the life of the Buddha, I mean, he talks about himself all the time. Sure. You know, when I was a da-da-da, when I was a da-da, you know, back in my youth, you know. I mean, this is absolutely essential for us to communicate with one another and to share what our individual experience is. So just to be clear out front that, you know, not to get caught in this particular dilemma. What he did say is this. He says, do not regard the five aggregates as self. And what, you know, some of you are quite familiar with this, but it's basically saying there is this body and mind. As a human being, you get issued this body and mind when you're born. And this teaching on the five aggregates is just a more complex model of that same thing. There's the body, and then there's four aspects to the mind: feeling, perception, what are called kama formations or mental formations, the moods, the mind states, and consciousness itself. And so he says, when we do that, when we cling to them, when we get attached to the experience of the body and mind, this is what constitutes suffering. This is one of his definitions of suffering. So, I mean, you may recall in the first discourse that he gave after his enlightenment, you know, he enjoyed the experience of his enlightenment for a period of several weeks, and then he went seeking people to teach, and he went through a couple of different aspects of that, but then ended up coming to the place where the five ascetics that he had practiced with for a long time were, and taught them the Four Noble Truths. That there is difficulty, it has a cause, it can stop, and there's a way to that end. And in the First Noble Truth, we've touched some of that when we were looking at the teaching on dukkha, opening to the experience of dukkha, where the Buddha runs through this litany of things that constitute suffering. Rebirth, sickness, aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair, having to associate with things we don't like, being separated from things we like, not getting what we want. Sounds like a pretty exhaustive list, one that we're very familiar with, right? But then there's this little catchphrase at the end of this list, and he says, in brief, the five focuses of the grasping mind are suffering. The five focuses of identity are suffering. It's a different translations for this. But, you know, at the time, it's interesting, he didn't explain what he meant by that. You know, not in that sutta, anyway. But, and there's some speculation that after he gave the talk, he didn't give another talk for a week, and that maybe during that intervening week, certainly he taught the five ascetics, and he might have explained some of the finer details of the Noble Truths. And he might have explained some of this. But the second talk that he gave is called the Anattalakkhana Sutta, and it is the teaching on the non-self characteristic. Very, very good one. I recommend it to you if you want to read it. It goes through some very fine details about the non-existence of self. One of the key things is this kind of walkthrough of the various forms of clinging and how it is that constitutes our suffering. So he's really, you know, as he's such a good teacher, as he does, he keeps shining the spotlight on what we as practitioners need to look at, need to see, in order to see what he saw. So, in a manner of speaking, what he's saying in this is that in an ordinary unenlightened individual, these five, the body, feeling, perception, mental formations, moods, mind states, and consciousness, are, in a way, they're kind of infected with clinging. It's very difficult for an unawakened human being to experience the body and mind without some way of relating to them from a vantage point of self. It's really in there. It's kind of rock solid in there through eons of delusion, but there it is. One way or another, we identify with this body and mind. And it's kind of, I mean, just contemplate that right there. I mean, virtually every world religion says we aren't this body and mind. Not who we are, but not all of them explain what they mean by that. You know, and this particular teaching, I think, is what the Buddha's effort at that, to say this is how you get caught up in that, and how you think you are that, and this is how to get free of it. So in this teaching on anatta, it basically states that we get caught up in our experience. And instead of just letting experience be what it is, what happens is that the mind, it's like, it's as if it has something to say about it. Or it wants to do something with it. It wants to manipulate it or play with it or something like this. And you've probably seen this, but I don't know about you, but before I practiced, I didn't even know that was happening, let alone actually see the danger in doing that. And so what it affects essentially is that having something to say and wanting to do something with it is like a It's like a subtle movement of the mind. You know, there's what you experience, and then something gets added on. There's like a tag, and the content, if you will, of that tag is moi. It almost always has something to do with me. It says something about me and something that I want, don't want, all of that. And as we'll see, I'll kind of unpack this a little bit further. So, but we get caught up in it and we identify it. And so there, just consider, there is experience. There is the moment's experience. And then in the mind, we grab hold of it and manipulate or do something or say something about it. And then what happens over time through repetition and through not seeing it is that identification or that way of relating to what it is that we're experiencing from the vantage point of me, that starts to dominate. It becomes the dominant experience in the moment. And you can, as you watch, as a practitioner, you watch and see how that becomes more real than the experience itself. We literally drop living where we are and move in to this new abode, this new experience, and that's basically where we spend our lives. You know, in the unawakened state, or not seeing this, or not knowing that one has options, and not exercising those options in those moments, then we really have no options. We're kind of at the mercy of it, and which would all be fine if this habit of grasping and identification wasn't a suffering state. You know, it's what the experience of it is suffering, and what it causes us to do is create more of the same. So what he's saying here is that it's this subtle movement of the mind that actually gives us the sense of self. And it's a distortion. It's not reality. It's not actually what's happening. I like to call it my constant comment about what's happening. You know, it's a way of relating to that. But it is where we live. So you get that feeling, especially as you watch this over the years. You constantly have this feeling of life's over here and I'm over here. I'm living like a short distance from myself, and I'm trying to, as a practitioner, I'm trying to reconcile those, trying to get it down to just that, just one, just the simple reality of what I'm experiencing. So it's weird because we think we're living life, but we're actually living our comment about it, we're actually living in a way of relating about it because of this grasping. And that's what he means by that little phrase. The five focuses of the grasping mind are suffering. That's what he's getting at. So as practitioners, we want to be able to examine our experience, and that's what we do. That's what the meditation is all about. So looking at this body and mind, that's what the foundations of mindfulness sets up. It's a way of looking in a very systematic way at what's going on with the body and mind. And in the sutta, he actually says, if these experiences of the aggregates were self, then you would be able to exercise some semblance of control over them. But, you know, try not to remember painful memories. Try not to think about things that you don't want to think about. Try to not behave in ways that you don't want to behave. It's a constant struggle. There's something else going on here. That setup that moves in and tries to manage and control everything actually isn't very effective. You know, if it's doing its job, it's not doing it very well. You know, I still have all this stuff I don't like. I still get, my body still goes through sickness that I don't want, or, you know, these kinds of things. And so, as practitioners, what we want to be able to do is just scrutinize our moment-to-moment experience with an eye to seeing that movement of the mind, seeing how in essence, we're constructing a sense of self and how that's formed, and then discerning or sort of being there for the experience of that, so that we get it, that this is actually a movement of the mind that we would be wise to get on top of somehow, or to intercept, or to try to catch, because it really is our suffering. And then gradually, over the months and years of practice, to learn, basically, how to deconstruct it, how it gets deconstructed in the process. I think a lot of it, really, is sort of, it's not so much a doing as an attending issue. And as I often say, the mind is not stupid. When it begins to see that it's doing that, what it feels like to do that, and the incredible separation it sets up in our very being. It's like we so want to be here. I mean, don't you? We so want to be here, and there's all this junk, you know, that just keeps dominating the experience. And so much so that, I once saw it like trying to find the matching sock in my drawer in the dark, you know? It's like, I'm in here somewhere. You just had that feeling. I just want to find now. I just want to be here, but I can't, because this unbelievable, incessant habit of mine to be preoccupied in this way. It's the weirdest thing. And yet we want to see it. This is what insight into anatta is all about. So this process is very important, to be able to see what's actually going on here. Insight into non-self is deeply entwined with liberation of the mind, with the end of suffering. You know, when we talk about what the Buddha experienced, he actually experienced a freedom from this habit. So it is a lot of what defines a Buddha. It's kind of like, that's what he wants us to do. He's kind of pointing and trying to help us to see this. And I would venture to say, too, that as this understanding of the truth about self and non-self, if you will, is seen, and this is gradually, over months, years, perhaps lifetimes of practice, I don't know, then we begin to realize for ourselves how the sense of self is constructed. We begin to see that for ourselves. And it's been my experience, anyway, that as that happens, then practice just gets richer and richer and richer, because this is the mechanism right here for attachment. This is how it's happening. And as we weaken that tendency of attachment and grasping, then now you can really start to practice. If you can feel that. It's like that bit that lets go is increasingly a piece of cake. You know, I'm not going to go there. I know where that goes. And it's too brutal. It's too painful. Little by little, we get glimmers. In some areas of our lives, it's easier to see than others. Really delight in that growing capacity for non-attachment. So, but how do we do it? You know, how do we scrutinize the experience, and how do we see non-self? They're hard to cover in one evening, but just want to walk through and give up, hopefully, I mean, some things that might be useful as we're working with this in our lives. So as we practice, and when I say that, I don't mean just what goes on the cushion. In fact, I find that insight into non-self happens a heck of a lot more off the cushion than on the cushion. You know, as we look and observe and pay attention in daily life, and everything that's going on in life, we'll notice the body. So just noticing what's going on with the body and how we're relating to it. It's seeing this. So there's sensation, there's the experience of the various forms and kinds of sensation in the body. And the way the Buddha talked about this is that sensation can be described, if you will, and explained as really one form or another of the four elements of materiality, earth, air, fire, and water. So from one moment to the next, we're hot, cold, you know, things are heavy, they're light, they're dry, they're moist, things like this. And so that's the actual direct experience of sensation in the body. But watch as you experience these things, what happens. It's wild. It's amazing. I mean, I was telling the story the other night in one of the other groups about one time sitting at a computer and the room had gotten cold, and the body feels the cold. And in a way that we do with ourselves, that the mind sort of articulates to itself what's happening. So it says, I'm cold. And then the very next thought was, you don't need to be cold, it's okay in here. Right? It's like, what? When you can see how a sense of sort of having, this is a tangle of a couple of the aggregates, there's a certain view about what should be or shouldn't be, getting tangled up with what actually is. But the interesting thing to watch is where do you go? We start to tangle with an absolutely absurd thought, and can sit there with a lot of confusion. Maybe this is an oversimplification, but you know, use it metaphorically, what we do with what is, and an opinion or a view about what we think should be in the body. It's amazing, but you can, and people, you know, often report just tremendous confusion around simple things like eating or getting enough sleep or exercise. Just a lot of confusion. And how does that confusion happen? You know, except that there's ideas about what the body needs or should do instead of actually tuning into what's going on with the body. We don't stay there. We get into a heady relationship with it, if you will. I mean, I actually watched I got older and had to pee several times a night. I've laid in bed arguing about whether or not to get up and pee. You know, to pee or not to pee. It's ridiculous. But you do. And what is that? And this is the construct that the Buddha's trying to point to. You know, you've probably done this, right? I mean, you wouldn't be laughing. It's amazing. But, so, can you see what's happening here? There's an experience, and then there's a grasping to it in one way or another. Some of it's liking and not liking, some of it's having a view about it, some of it's going into a mind state about it, but that dominates. And the experience itself is kind of lost in the shuffle. So those are just simple examples, but you know, I call them like my Goldilocks effect kind of things. You know, it's too hot, it's too cold, it's not hot, it's so hot. The mind goes bonkers over trying to find. I mean, it's understandable. We're just trying to be comfortable, but you know, if you don't catch it, you know, you can spend endless hours arguing with yourself about these kinds of things. But that's just that, and then other things the body does, like get sick and age and die. You know, watch what it does about this stuff. You know? It's amazing, but it's interesting to watch that, especially around like aging and sickness, the body is very literal in terms of what it's actually experiencing. From the perspective of the body, there isn't any aging. You know. It's a concept. It's a notion. But it becomes very real. You know, from the sensations that I have in my body now at 63 are the same as they were when I was 5. They're still earth, air, fire, and water. Mm-hmm. they still are characterized in that way. But you know, you can see the setup, the potential for compounding what may already be some difficulty. Because let's be honest, the experience of the elements is rarely balanced. You know, every now and then you sort of scan the body and you go, wow, I feel good. Nothing hurts. You know? It's not too hard, it's not too soft, it's not too hot or cold, you know. Every now and then. But we'll go bonkers when it is the way it actually is almost all the time, which is in a state of continuous movement of these elemental forces. You know, it's fascinating to watch it. So, just trying to get to a direct experience of the body, you discover over the months and years of practice that you don't need a lot of mental activity about what's going on with the body. It's extraneous. There's just all we need is to know what's happening, to pay attention to it. And the process of it, I think, is a fabulous one, because over the years of practice, what people report the most, I think, is that they are increasingly becoming better stewards, better caretakers of the body, because they are not arguing, entering into battle about what's happening, not grasping what's happening and forming some sense of me about it, and then trying desperately to get rid of it because it's not the me I want, you know, in any given moment. It's fascinating stuff. So just to acknowledge, though, that it does take time to develop this relationship with the body, a more raw and fundamental experience of the body. And I know I struggle with it. I bet all of us do in one way or another. It's been my experience, I think it just needs to be said, that very few people are connected with the body. Very few people are attuned to the direct experience of the body. And so know that, and just know that it's a process. What happens is that our reaction to the body dominates, and that's where we live. Just kind of interferes with the whole thing, and we move into that kind of comment about it. But it has to be said, though, too, this is very important. We were looking at this in one of the suttas in the Going Forth group. The mindfulness of the body, awareness of the body as it actually is one of the key players in the process of waking up. And it serves to really ground us in the Dhamma, if we can connect. So it's worth putting the kind of attention on it that I think the Buddha's pointing to here. So then just noticing feeling. And when we talk about feeling, as you know, we're talking about the not emotions, but the experience of pleasure, pain, and neither. It's kind of a kinesthetic experience, but also a mental event. And the Buddha's putting this in the mind. And so we watch over time, and we become attuned to the fact that there's almost always a leaning in the mind around feeling. You know, the direct experience of pleasure, pain, and neither, pristine, if you can get to it, you know, because the wanting more pleasure, the wanting to get away from pain, is so so strong. Such a shoot from the hip response, and so dominates our experience that's where we go very quickly and very, very completely. And on one level, that's fine, and it makes absolute perfect sense. You look at what's going on around feeling, and as human beings, we're just trying to survive. We're just trying to be comfortable. We're trying to find that place of ease between pleasure and pain, you know, the middle way. But I think what the Buddha's kind of pointing to is that these experiences are, go with the territory of being born. And there really isn't any getting away from them. Feeling, particularly, feeling and perception arise simultaneously with every single moment of contact. Every single moment. There's always feeling. And I think it's interesting to watch through the years of practice how, as we work with this, we become more and more sensitized to it. You know, you start to feel yourself as sort of pulsing. You know, just the... It's a constant expansion with pleasure and contraction with pain. So what we want to see is just to look and see that there is the experience of these two, pleasure and pain, and neither, but that what happens on the heels or right away is something gets added to that, and this movement of the mind overtakes our experience. The sad part is that we move away from the experience of feeling in that, and we move into our head about what we are actually feeling, and that dominates. And I think this is particularly sad because, again, we really want to feel. But the direct experience of feeling without an overlay, without something to say about it, without moving into the what we have to say about it. Again, it is quite rare. What he's trying to get us to is a way of just embracing the moment. We would be better off if we could just do that. And this is an experience of non-self in relation to feeling, not relating to it from the vantage point of self. So just to notice the impulses, and notice that, that tendency to do something with pleasant and unpleasant feeling, and in a way call upon the training that we set up through our meditation practice, the constant coming back. You wander off, come 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 back. That is not for nothing. What that's actually doing is training the mind to be here and to be with experience. And this one about feeling is very important because we've got to see for ourselves if that movement of the mind to get more pleasant feeling and away from unpleasant feeling, we have to see if that's serving us. In the unawakened state, we don't know that. It's just, it's kind of like a biological impulse. And literally, I think in practice, what we have to do is take on our biology. Yeah, this is one of the ways that we do it. So now, perception, this is an interesting one, and I think probably one of the biggies, at least for me it is, and it's about views and ideas. There's a lot to it, but just I just want to zero in on views and ideas and opinions, these notions that we have, these biases that we have in the mind. And interesting to note that one of the synonyms for this teaching on anatta is it's non-self, but it's also often referred to as self-view. It's actually a view to what is happening from the vantage point of self, and the identification or the grasping onto that view instead of what's happening. See what it is? It's a grasping of perception. It's a grasping of a view about experience instead of the actual experience. So we get caught up in our ideas and views about things, and especially my views, the right views, that kind of thing, gets very, very strong. And then they become something to defend and debate. And there's no end to the tangles that we get into with this kind of thing. We do this with our views about the external world, you know, our perception about the way things are, or the way things ought to be, the way that we think things should be. Yeah? Can you feel that?
Mm-hmm.
As soon as we get caught in that, then the way they are is lost in the shuffle. You know, you can watch this one when particularly when somebody is behaving in a way that we don't like, or treating us in a way that we don't like. You know, you watch it. So it's this way, but it shouldn't be. They shouldn't be doing that. That's not right. You know, but it's this way. But it should be another way. That's not the right way. They're doing it wrong. But they're doing it this way, right? You have to keep relentlessly coming back to what actually is, and trying to open the heart to the experience of that, because that's where the action is. The way it should be, the way I think it ought to be, that tends to dominate the experience. That's a suffering state. That's what he's pointing to here. So we do that around things that are going on in the world, other people. They shouldn't be that way. They should be the way I want them to be. It's crazy. We suffer a lot with that. But definitely we turn it internally as well. And this is the setup. And this is where it gets really deadly. Where it's a setup for a tremendous amount of self-loathing and self-criticism. Because unseen to us, much of the time, we're all holding views about the way we ought to be, or the way we would like to be. And then there's the reality of the way we are. And if these two don't get reconciled, if we don't see what's going on here, then it's just a huge setup for beating up on ourselves. And boy, we can be good at that, you know. And so, as if smacking ourselves around is going to get us to a place of peace. And the whole of practice, really, is around opening to what we see in ourselves. You know, so if this tendency to grasp a view about that is dominating, we're never going to get there. It's tricky stuff, but that's what I think he's pointing to. You know, lose the perception and view about the world, about yourself, about other people, and try to find the reality of what actually is. And don't make a self around it all. Just let it be what it is. I think it should be this way. No. That, lose that kind of thing. And really, when you examine it, some of the most painful experiences in our lives come from this sense of there's a right thing to do. There's a right way to be. And I think the Buddha, hands down, is just challenging that. That it doesn't make any sense in the reality of opening to what is. Those two can't be reconciled. There isn't any right way to be. There isn't any right thing. I don't know about you guys, but for me, that was just, that is, has been, and is, continues to be something that is a very revolutionary idea, a very heart-opening idea, to allow it to be the way that it is. So now, with formations, the mental states, just briefly about that, we want to notice what happens with our states of mind. Things come into the mind, various states of mind, and we all have patterns and dispositions, you know, that tend to make up the way you are and make up the way that I am. And attachment involves getting caught up in these, either by becoming that's who I am, or hating them, which, you know, does the same thing. It ends up, it's another, the attachment is either indulging or resisting either form of those. And it's fascinating to watch it, because you can't win with that kind of attitude. You know, we're trying to get to me. We're trying to get to accept and see what's actually here. But attaching to states, and with the combination of having views about what's a right and a wrong way to be, you can see the setup. I mean, much of our counseling, whether it's a psychotherapist or through Buddhist practice, is trying to untangle this tangle about idea attaching to the way that we are, attaching to ideas about the way we ought to be, this kind of thing. And so in practice, we're developing the capacity just to soften around what arises in the mind. And we were talking about this in the group, the Monday night group, about karma and karma formations of the mind, that how nonsensical it is to sort of fight the way that we are. You know, it doesn't, from a perspective of practice, or from the perspective of somebody who's trying to wake up, it doesn't make any sense. Because what arises into the mind is already set in place. It's a fruit, it's a product, it's an outcome of past actions. It's a conditioned arising. And so what arises in the mind is what arises in the mind. Not wanting it there, or arguing with it, or getting lost in it, this is the pathway to suffering. And it's very, very helpful to realize that there's what arises is totally neutral in the moment of its arising. So even if you have this tendency to react to things with this huge whoosh of hostility or anger, in the moment of that arising, there's nothing to be said about it, except that it has arisen. It's not you. It doesn't say you're a bad person. There's no reason to smack ourselves around for it being there. Rather, our objective is to see it so that we can get a wedge in there, have some options whether or not we're going to go with it, and certainly not turn it back on ourselves. Certainly not beat up on ourselves for it being there. We want to get a sense of how it feels to be that way. So in the end, I mean, it doesn't, you don't really have to work at trying to get rid of a sense of self. One simply wants to see these movements of the mind and see the effect of that, to get, to feel the contraction just in the grasping, let alone what it feels like to be there, to be caught in that. So it's more about seeing that, and seeing how a sense of self is constructed. And it's actually a tag. It's an add-on. It's something that is being added to this moment's experience. And another way to see it is that the way that this mind works, this human mind works, is that it refers back to itself. It's like a feedback loop in the mind. Right? And it's constantly telling itself what's happening. And self-view is kind of riding on that feedback loop. It's just caught in that. And so that, something happens, and get me out of here, I hate this, you know? And that chatter in the mind about what we like and don't like, what we want and don't want, it's all superfluous. It's like it's superficial. It doesn't have anything to do with anything. it's just the mind feeding back that it's uncomfortable, or something doesn't feel good, or something's uncomfortable, or I'm in pain in one way or another. That's all it's doing. So if you could see it as that feedback loop, it can actually be useful rather than something that we want to fight or resist. So just to see for ourselves over the months and years of practice that it's doing this, and decide for ourselves through that process of where we want to be. The sense of self, it's been my experience that it just it dies a very slow death, but it does weaken over time, and you find yourself not grabbing things in the way that we used to, and not getting caught up in the way that we used to. Just to notice that and feel good about it, allow that to happen. And I trust, I mean, I just have the utmost confidence in this process, that if we just apply ourselves, it will take us to freedom. We don't even have to fully know how that's happening, but just to pay attention to what's happening and see the consequences of that. Okay? So I hope this is helpful in some small way. I hope it demystifies us a little bit. It sounds like such a weird teaching, but it's just that. It's just a pointing to a way of constructing reality and moving into that constructed reality instead of what actually is. Yeah. So do you have some thoughts or questions, comments? No, I didn't. I was worried about the time. Sorry. The way that we attach to consciousness, just very simply, is, and this is where a lot of the action is actually, but it's that there's seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, feeling. So there's a sight. The eye sees it, right? And this is a very organic experience. But watch, right on the heels of that, or simultaneously with it, you get a very visceral sense of I am seeing. I see. That's the tag. Mm-hmm. There isn't any I see. There's just seeing. It's just like Bucky Fuller said, I seem to be a verb.
Yeah.
But we're making it a noun. So try to be a verb. I mean, I often wonder about that, the whole idea of a supreme being. I think in Buddhism they would make that a verb. Mm-hmm. There is an experience of supreme being. Being. In a supreme way. Good stuff, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Good luck with it. So thank you.